Greetings, everybody. This is Tabitha. Welcome to another edition of White Wellness. Today is March 15th, 2021, broadcasting out of New York for the American National Radio Network. That song right there was Blind Melon with No Rain, way back in 1992. And just watching that video, haven't watched it in a long time, it just looks so much older, like, than I guess it was, because everything now is just so different, like visually. It's almost like hypnotic, and it's the lights are flashing. I really don't take in a lot of this new media because it's very, very deceptive, I think, more so than it ever has been before. It's definitely a magic tool, but just seems like looking back at the 90s, which really wasn't that long ago, it just seems like such a reality shift, I guess is the right phrase to use, than what we're dealing with currently. I was watching this video before this on YouTube. It was recommended to me. I guess I get a lot of vintage stuff because of the music I typically pick on here. And it was a video that was shot in a 7-Eleven in 1987 in Florida near Disney World. And it showed just some guys, just, you know, everyone in the store, of course, was white. Everyone was normal, pretty decent looking, attractive, dressed well, and kindly. Nobody was like psychotic or crazy. And they were just going around interviewing people in the 7-Eleven, asking them what they were up to, what they were buying. And it just looking at it for some reason, it seemed like it was like the 50s. Like it was looking, I was looking at it like I wasn't alive when I was, when that was happening, even though, of course, I was seven back in 87, but just, wow, it seems like everything changed so quickly, especially visually. And now when you look back, it's really very, very obvious. So the title of today's show is Don't Drink the Kool-Aids. And I have a picture of the Kool-Aid guy on the avatar for the broadcast. So today's broadcast is going to be about not falling into or succumbing to any of the Zog psyops. Not zero, because, well, once you fall for one, you're bound to fall for the other. And of course, in the Oyvi psyop known as AIDS, AIDS stands for Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, which originally was known as GRIDS, but they got rid of that when they wanted to promote AIDS as a psyop that anybody who had sex could get. In the beginning, they were promoting it, of course, for intravenous drug use and for homosexual sex, but then it became something anybody could get, whoever they were, anytime, anywhere. But originally it was called GRIDS, gay-related immune disease, or something to that effect. So in a way, if we're going to, quote, drink the Kool-Aids, that would basically be doing things that the Oyvi, Shitstum, Skeksis, Bolshevik beast tells us is good to do, because then we would be acquiring an immune deficiency syndrome, right? Because all of their pogroms, when you think about it, they all damage the immune system, whether it be their nutritional pogroms, whether it be the ones that traumatize us, like visually and emotionally. All of these things affect our immune system. When you think about it, what's going on right now, people getting ill, that's their immune system not doing well. So, and when you think of stuff like people getting like things like cancer, that's an immune system disease. All of these diseases are about the immune system. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time today talking about diseases of the immune system, going over some hoaxes of some diseases, as well as talking about some information about vaccination, more of this hoaxing. Of course, I'm sure if you're listening to this, you know that the germ theory is a hollow hoax, that the House of Allopathy is built on the germ theory of disease, which is dependent on vaccination, and that vaccination isn't just toxic for our immune systems. It also has no basis in any reality, because you cannot, quote, inoculate someone against something that isn't contagious, that basically is a detox that you're supposed to go through. But of course, the allopathic system has a war on the body. It's not about working in harmony. Key way to tell that they have a war on the body, look what they do when they give, quote, treatment for cancer. Look what they do for someone who has sexual dysphoria, who feels like they're in the wrong body. Maybe they don't even feel like they're the opposite sex per se, but they still feel like they're in the wrong body. What does allopathy say? Let's cut these parts off. I mean, allopathy is brutal. It's really dark age stuff when you think about it. The thing is that they've built up this billion-dollar polished industry with white coats and slick labs, and all of this is basically just a mirage. It's kind of like what they did when Crisco. When Crisco first hit the market and they tried to introduce PUFAs to the American public, of course, this was a terribly toxic thing to do. They were using cottonseed oil, which was a industrial byproduct, but they had to market it to us in a way that made it seem like it was healthy. So they told people that if you use lard, you had a gross, filthy house, and that you your children were unruly. And then when they had the Crisco commercial, they had a very slick, very clean look, almost like sterile laboratory look. They also had showing how crystalline it was and how it would look in a very just like almost like a futuristic type of way. I think they've been selling us this futuristic thing via allopathy, but also through all this like shiny stuff, which I guess goes back to like, I guess you'd say the 40s or the 50s with the Crisco stuff, and also with some of the first incarnations of what the future was going to look like in the 50s. It was always shiny and slick and silvery. And I think that they have used that same type of thing to promote this allopathic thing. So we're going to talk about the immune system and how the things that they do to it that causes problems. So first I wanted to talk about something, a disease that probably many people have heard of before, which is leprosy. And this is not a contagious disease, like, well, we've been told that it is, like we've been told a lot of these things. And of course, when we tell people that something is, quote, contagious, what does that do? That makes them fear it, right? As opposed to something that's not contagious. So people are more likely to fear things that they think are contagious. That's pretty much what it comes down to, or things that is promoted as just like a completely dead end, like you have to do this for a cure type of thing. So there is a myth that leprosy is actually a contagious disease. And of course, back in the day, people who were, quote, lepers were put into these communities. And look what's happened just in a kind of a smaller scale with people who buy into the Oyedei PSYOP and just what's happening in the world. People are quarantining themselves, right? So this is kind of in the same way. So reading this, of course, keep in mind the last year plus, which I'm sure won't be hard for most people to do. So here's a bit about the leprosy contagion myth. In light of the question about illness being contagious, I was reflecting on an experience I had in the late 1980s. I lived in Louisiana and volunteered at a hospital in Carville, which was started in 1984 as the first U.S. inpatient hospital for those with leprosy. It closed in 1999. Often people were brought there and left by their families for lifetime quarantine. The site had many buildings, and there were closed walkways to get from one building to another. I was told patients had to walk in those walkways, not outside, so they would not risk infecting others. By the time I was there, they said we could interact without fear of contagion because they now had a medication for the disease, not a vaccine. But in the past, these people were feared as, quote, biohazards and were not allowed to leave except for short periods. Many tried to escape but were captured and returned. For a long time, they were not allowed to marry for fear of infecting the children, but that restriction was finally lifted. Many changed their names out of shame and fear for the family's reputation. So as I'm reading this, I'm thinking to myself, what if they're going to foment the idea of an even worse strain coming around, like they already have been, and then say people who, quote, have this strain have to basically be treated like lepers? Just a thought. The hospital was run by Catholic sisters for a long time, and I learned that none of them were ever, quote, infected. At the time, this seemed like a miracle. They also said that researchers could not infect normal lab animals, but they finally could infect the armadillo, plentiful in Louisiana. All of it seemed sad and puzzling. A friend organized a boat trip up the Mississippi River for some patients and others. Those with leprosy begged us not to tell anyone where they were from. They were thrilled to be out in normal life and accepted. I met a woman patient from South America who had been sent there. She said that it took a long time, but she was finally able to marry another patient. Her husband wrote a heartbreaking biography in which he explained that he grew up in a small mountain community. As a boy, he started getting odd nerve twitches where he would swat at a bug on his leg, only to realize there was no bug. He had other symptoms that puzzled local doctors, who eventually feared it was leprosy. The family community and doctors were shocked because they knew the boy had never been exposed to leprosy. Unfortunately, the boy was sent to Carville, where he lived his life abandoned by his family. That's awful. For centuries, leprosy has provoked fear as a terrible, contagious dis-ease. But in light of the new ideas about what causes dis-ease, I am seeing leprosy in a new light. For countless people suffering with leprosy over time, maybe their plight could have been avoided had researchers been willing to ask, what if the cause is not what we think? What if it is not contagious? What other possible causes are there? And then there's a note written thereafter. That was a letter that someone had written into the Weston A. Price Quarterly magazine. Oftentimes I have some good jewels of information in here. And then the editor wrote back, The symptoms of leprosy, severe disfiguring skin sores, and nerve damage in the arms, legs, and skin areas are similar to certain symptoms of B vitamin deficiencies, which were especially common in the South in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So there you go. A little bit of a lifting of one of the things that people always feared, maybe not currently, but it seems like decades ago, that was something that was depicted in movies. Like I remember seeing a movie, I think it was a cartoon, I saw it, and they depicted someone who was a leper as being able to basically pull their arms and legs off, like their legs, arms and legs were falling off and they were covered in sores. And yeah, I guess they've done what they've done with everything via Hollyweird, right? Made it look like it was worse than it was, different than it was, or just some way to kind of, I guess, traumatize people. Just wanted to share that there. I had not heard of that before in regards with leprosy. Of course, I've always been skeptical of what they tell us is the cause of certain diseases. I mean, you'd have to be at this point to be skeptical of, I would say, well, pretty much everything. It just would behoove you to. Otherwise, you could just be taking something at what you think is face value. And well, that's not a very good idea, especially now with everything going on. So here are some other things I wanted to talk about. Just going to go through a couple of things that I have. Here's one that I found out too. This is very awful. Of course, already we have birth rates down here in America, and also I think in the white world in general, but there's been a rise of still birth rates during Oyed Ai. Of course, this was to be expected in a certain way because, well, they're stressing out and poisoning the people even more so now than they have been for, you know, I guess it's almost like they turned everything up full blast in the last, you know, couple of years. And yesterday or last year, they just kind of, you know, finally like pulled the crank down or pulled that handle down. That's what it seems like. So there's been a raise of stillbirths during Oyed Ai. And on a high note, this is a low note, of course, but on a high note, there are more people who were seeking to do birthing and stuff like that out of the Zogspital, which is a good thing, and having more of a return to the way that most people were born 100 years ago at home. And there's been, that has been a silver lining of Oyed Ai, people who are realizing, you know what, I really have to pull back my dependence on the Bolshevik beast Skeksis system. So the unsavory aspect is the stillbirths. The silver lining is more people are giving birth at home. So a significant rise in stillbirths worldwide since the coronavirus pandemic began has experts worried. Based on the data from more than 20,000 women in India, stillbirths increased from 14 per thousand to 21 by the end of May, a rise of 50%. Birth data from a large London hospital indicates a fourfold increase in the incidence of stillbirths. Public health officials are blaming the increase on disruptions in healthcare. That's not really what's going on, obviously, such as the lack of prenatal visits to physicians, but we can think of other reasons. Hypoxia due to wearing the mask, domestic abuse due to lockdowns, and exposure to 5G. So look at that. See how deep the genocide agenda goes? This is what they are doing, and oftentimes is going to have reverberations on people in many ways. But that mask thing with the hypoxia, I mean, if you're not getting enough oxygen, especially if you're pregnant, I mean, that's a really deadly situation, especially if you're wearing one of those blue masks. I still see people wearing these blue masks places, like, you know, like the medical ones, whatever, the ones that have all the Teflon that people are like breathing in all the time and they're actually going to get a legitimate respiratory, like, you know, disease from doing that. I'm just wondering, are these people thinking like this is going to be over tomorrow? Like the costume is just going to poof, like not exist? Like, yeah, they've been lifting these mandates and such, but the costume for the ritualistic role that it played is definitely still here. And I'm noticing it a lot of the youth, like the Zoomer age ones, it's very much become part of their costume, part of their look. They even wear like trendy masks. They all wear them together. So I've seen some of the younger set walking around, and I think this is very much just like what they do. I think it's really not for us anyway. Like us who are a little bit older, it's really not for us. It's really for these younger people to really fully indoctrinate them into the system shitstem. So just wanted to share that there about Oyedei and stillbirths and that bit about leprosy. So now onward to a little bit more information for the show. And this is also going to pertain to vaccination. All of the things, like I said, are going to be about don't drink the Kool-Aids, things that are going to cause people to have immune issues. And when you think about it, pretty much everything they promote will give people immune system issues. Like it's really that bad. Like all the quote treatments they promote, the diet they promote, pretty much everything they promote is to lower your immune system, lower your resistance, make you docile. That's why they're promoting this tranny meat and this Franken meat now. That's to make people docile. They're not docile enough. They've got to be more docile. They've got to basically trick people into not eating meat by making fake meat. I mean, things are so bad when you think about it in a certain way that people need to be tricked into thinking that non-meat or some lab-grown crud is meat, and they have to be tricked into thinking a man is a woman. And then if you object to that, it's almost like something is the problem with you. I mean, people just shouldn't be allowed to get away with these ideas, I don't think, anyway. I mean, either just don't entertain people who feel like this, or just completely laugh in their face. That's what I would do. But hopefully, not to be too much of a downer in all of this. This is lifting in a certain way. I think we're just really seeing the bifurcation, because sometimes you can tell yourself or say to yourself, people are just going crazy. Now they're wearing two costumes. Now they're wearing the gloves as well as the chat feed bag. But then you can hear stories about people doing stuff that's very positive and very counter to this and pulling more into themselves. So I think we're really going to see very much even more of a bifurcation with all this vaccination crud. Which I'm not surprised. The mask was one piece of the bifurcation puzzle, but I feel like the vaccination one is like the one that's like, it's set in stone. Like the mask comes off, right? Maybe the mask does some damage that doesn't come off, but the vaccination doesn't come off. There's no taking the vaccination off after you get it. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about peanut allergy. So of course, that's something that I remember growing up in the 80s and the 90s. I never remember having a child in one of my classes when I was in the public schooling system who had a peanut allergy. And now everybody's got a peanut allergy, it seems, right? Everyone's got an allergy to everything. And of course, the quality of food is way worse now than it was in the 80s and 90s. Not that it was spectacular and amazing back then, but it was certainly a lot better. And also the vaccination schedule has become a lot more ample since those times. So I wanted to read a review of the history of the peanut allergy epidemic, because this just seemed to come out of nowhere. And of course, Zog is behind it. We can't be surprised there. And I also found a little note about it too. Here we go. I found this comment first. I was just, sometimes I find really good comments if you're on YouTube that actually like make sense and historical, believe it or not. But I just want to read this little comment about the peanut oil, and then I want to read this review of the allergy epidemic, because this is another thing that they've been using to give us Kool-Aids, essentially. It's ludicrous, but just an example of the white coat union's usual fudge packing of chemical and mechanical deviltry. They've gotten away with creating, quote, peanut allergies that never existed in history by putting the oil in the jabs, aka the vaccination, as an adjuvant, despite circa 1911 or so the discovery that injecting proteins creates anaphylactic reactions. How many dead children since from that one act of fraud for profit? So they're deliberately setting people up for AIDS, essentially, right? Immune deficiencies, right? If they're going to inject you with a protein that creates an anaphylactic reaction, I mean, why? Crazy. I remember one time over, I don't know, I guess it was a couple of years ago. It's hard to keep track of time sometimes with all this Oyedei stuff. I feel like the last year just zoomed into like a different year. And it's usually, I'm usually pretty keen with that, but it just, time feels different now. I guess that's the best way to say it. But I remember I was giving a lecture, I guess a couple of years ago now, And I had mentioned to one of the ladies in the, who was taking the lecture that I was giving, this was like, I wasn't talking about the Oyves, obviously, and race and things like that, but I was still talking about provocative ideas, like from the medical perspective. And I mentioned that peanut oil was put into vaccinations, and that was a way to give children peanut allergies. And she really couldn't believe how corrupt, like she was taken aback. Like she had this look of shock on her face. They could actually do that to people. And actually try to, like, you know, be basically giving them an immune suppressive system and inducing it, essentially. And then basically, you know, problem, reaction, solution. Oh, you have this problem, reaction, take all these medications, solution, lots of shekels and a damaged person. She couldn't believe that that was actually something that people could do, or people, entities, whatever. And she was actually an Oy Vey too, on top of it. So pretty wild. But yeah, I mean, they are always doing something nefarious. And this peanut oil thing, if vaccinations weren't bad enough, they have to put peanut oil in the adjuvants. And the adjuvants are all these things they add to the vaccination that aren't the actual virus stuff. It's all this extra stuff. It's all these things like aborted fetal cells and, you know, aluminum and all this terrible crud that has no place in the human body. That is a form of transhumanizing, not just this one that we have now, but all vaccinations are part of transhumanizing. Even when you think about it, eating hybridized food, which all of us have done, that's a form of some type of transhumanism or some type of engineering. Like, we really think about it, there's so many forms of it, just some forms are more hardcore than the other. So here is a little bit about this history of the peanut allergy epidemic, which of course, like the pandemic, was created. You remember all of these epidemics or pandemics? Look at obesity, the obesity epidemic. That was created. The history of the peanut allergy epidemic. This is a book written by Heather Frazier. Recently, the famous Home Alone movie actor Macaulay Culkin posted a funny quip to social media. Want to feel old? Today I turn 40. Like a relic from another age, Culkin's movies remind me of America that I grew up in almost a generation ago. And I'm the same age as him. I was 10 when that movie came out in 1990. It was not just a time when lack of air conditioning meant that people spent more time outdoors and on their porches, but also an era when seasonal allergies and asthma were the exception rather than the norm, and food allergies were uncommon. And of course, I remember those days. Maybe you remember those days too. It was a simpler time. 40 years after, food allergies are big business. They absolutely are. On the food industry side, quote, allergen-free foods are growing, multi-billion dollar segment of the food market. And yeah, that's another thing. You'll see it's free of all the allergens. Egg, dairy, wheat, shellfish, peanut, nuts, seeds. I think those are usually the six top allergies for people. So yeah, this is definitely a growing market, just like all the gluten-free, the keto. And that's the thing. They want people to kind of eat these foods in a box. Like when you think about it, they're already basically personalizing people's diets who follow this JWO crud by telling you, oh, we've damaged you this way. You know, you've got to be gluten-free, eat this. Oh, we've damaged you this way. You've got to eat the allergen-free. Here's your box of food. Like they're already rationing out like goyim rations of like boxed crud food when you really think about it. On the pharmaceutical industry side, drugs, treatments, EpiPens, and other inventions are likewise worth billions. In her 2010 book, The History of the Peanut Allergy Epidemic, so this book is 10 years old, but still, of course, relevant, Heather Frazier describes how we quickly moved from trying to sort out the causes of the allergy epidemic to simply managing symptoms. At the end of the day, she says, the questions of how and why this is happening remain unanswered. And that's, of course, is important that that happens, because it's always about treating the symptoms and making a war on the symptoms and not getting to the root cause. And that's pretty much the way you have to look at everything or anything, because that's really how the whole octopus hydra system works. It's always about doing something on the surface when really you have to ask yourself, who benefits? Why is this happening? What emerged instead in response to the mystery was a massive food allergy industry, the infrastructure of which included billions of dollars in the sale of, quote, free from foods, websites and blogs and magazines, and parent-initiated lobby groups. Among food allergies, peanut allergy is especially problematic because it is both widespread and deadly. Fraser cites a 1991 U.S. study which determined that 9 in 10 food allergies were due to ingestion of peanut or tree nuts. Why is a food that has been consumed across the entire world for 2,000 years suddenly a scourge, but only in certain countries? And I remember asking myself that, questioning that when this whole thing started to happen with, you know, finding out that everyone had an allergy to what. And I know from working as a chef, you know, in the past, that there were certain times when no nuts could be there because people have nut allergies, you know, especially children. It was almost like an expected thing where there were going to be no nuts. And I think now in the public school system, not in my day, but now you have to bring, you can't even bring in like cupcakes anymore, right? For like a kid's birthday. Back in the day, you'd bring in, you know, your mom would make cupcakes and they'd bring in cupcakes and it would be your party or something like that. You know, totally normal, affordable. Now you can't do that. Probably because of Oyed AI, you can't do it either. Like in a way, Oyed AI is like giving everybody a peanut allergy, essentially, right? It just puts the kibosh on like literally anything. This is the riddle. Yes. So why is a food that we've eaten for 2,000 years, why is it only in certain countries that this is happening? This is the riddle that Heather Fraser seeks to unravel, and she takes us across decades of research and science to a simple, factually sound conclusion. Fraser educates the reader about the interesting differences between sensitization to allergens, like the allergens found in peanuts, and reactions to allergens. This distinction is an important piece of the peanut allergy puzzle. Fraser's discussion of the most effective ways to elicit allergen sensitization in people is another vital clue to understanding the overall puzzle. Elicit allergen sensitization. That is what they're doing. They're looking to hijack our immune systems. The fact is that it is hard to become sensitized because the body has important systems and defenses that seek to keep it from happening unless we bypass them. Fraser does an excellent job of showing how the numerous theories and factors that have been used to explain the explosion in peanut allergies don't hold water. Can age, type of peanut, location, maternal consumption, or year of birth give us any insights into why this is happening? Is it hygiene or helminths or toxins? The data show that most of these are dead ends, but not all. A few of these variables point to disturbing conclusions, such as a sudden and drastic uptick in food allergies that began around 1990, or the New Zealand study, which found over 1,000 children and found that sizable proportions of the vaccinated subgroup had asthma episodes, 23%, asthma consultations, 23%, and consultations for other allergic illnesses, 30%. If the first half of the book shows why various theories cannot explain the peanut allergy epidemic, the second half seeks to make a clear case for what does explain it. In brief, as Fraser states, mass allergenic phenomena emerged as a side effect of a late 19th century technology, vaccination. So basically all these allergies, these are all the results of vaccination. And oftentimes that can result in a lot of other issues, because I've heard people say that allergies are from metabolic issues or gut issues. And of course, if someone's vaccinated, they're more likely to have those issues because vaccination destroys the immune system. It's AIDS. Fraser explores historical and scientific data showing how and why vaccinations and their adjuvants, the metals and other compounds used to increase vaccine effectiveness, bring about a known but ignored risk and, quote, side effect. Allergenic sensitization to the various things found in the vaccines, things like peanut oil. And peanut oil is actually used in a lot of restaurants. Of course, it's a high poof of fat. A lot of Chinese places will use it depending on what they can get it cheap for. So someone could be eating traces of this, been vaccinated, and not know what's wrong, you know, why they feel the way they do. Of course, some people are going to have a serious reaction to it. I mean, one more reason not to eat outside the house. But I'm thinking, even if someone was born in the 80s, if they kept on going to the pediatrician to get more of the vaccinations once this peanut like PSYOP thing happened, chances are, I guess, maybe the millennials were probably the first generation of people who got this peanut oil vaccination. Not to say the vaccinations that came in the prior generation didn't cause allergies, because they all can, but this peanut thing seems to be specific to millennial, zoomer, and alpha, because I don't think I've really ever met anybody older than a millennial who had a peanut allergy. Interesting how this all pulls together. In fact, the more effective a vaccine is, the greater the risk of allergies and other adverse effects. So the better the poison works, the worse the risk of adverse effects. If you want to know why peanut oil became the choice par excellence for vaccines, she provides a detailed account of the fascinating history that led to this modern calamity. I also appreciate that the fact that Fraser takes the time to help modern people understand why vaccinations came about and were so quickly accepted. In our time, we are separated from the horrors of the early 1800s illnesses caused by sudden and massive urbanization of large populations, along with incredibly poor sanitation and for some subpar nutrition. And of course, maybe all those illnesses that happened in the early 1800s, maybe those were, quote, well poisoning. I'm not taking the word for it that it was just these factors that they're naming here. I always like to look into that more. So perhaps that's a topic that I could look into, some of the, quote, illnesses of the early 1800s. I like researching and looking into medicine of the past. I think it's very interesting. But back then, if you were watching a loved one die of their, quote, skin slip off in the body sheets, would you also not cry out for some form of protection? That sounds horrifying. Initially, many people focused on the perceived benefits of vaccination, unaware of a myriad of risks. Well, it sounds to me like they probably created some type of situation that was a problem reaction solution that maybe we'll probably beg for a vaccination. But like I said, I'm going to have to look into this more, but now I'm interested. Far more was unknown than known. Also, 19th century science was undergoing rapid and radical transformation with the relatively new germ theory, which justified vaccination gaining more adherence. So it's so mind-seeing to me that this germ theory, which is really like less than 200 years old, this is a bigger religion than these old school religions. But I guess people who don't know fear. I think that's really what it comes down to. People who don't know just fear things. Although this book is primarily about the peanut allergy epidemic, it is full of other interesting, albeit disturbing, information. Fraser notes, for example, that increasingly the health of boys and the birth rate of boys has been impacted by environmental pollutants at a higher rate than girls. Estrogenic, that's why. In a small population downriver of polluting petrochemicals, female births outnumbered male births. Indeed, Chapter 3 alone was an eye-opening journey through parts of medical and Western history with which I was only partially familiar. Even the well-read among us are likely to find a lot of new information to add to our understanding of how we ended up where we are in terms of both health and medicine. So what they're doing is, see, they're they're over pumping women with estrogen and men too, so then they're more likely to have female children. And of course, that's what the Oive system really wants. I mean, they want to get rid of like all, I think, natural male and female eventually, but to get rid of like strong masculine men, you know, virile masculine men that could protect, that would behoove them to, you know, basically put the kibosh on that. So that's what one of the consequences of all this estrogen is. Where do things go from here? The medical community has acknowledged for quite some time that certain components of vaccination, such as the gelatin, are tied to allergic outbreaks. See alpha-gal syndrome in ticks, a false trail. That, I guess, was a spring issue. I think I have that one. Modern medicine also knows that the ever-increasing number of vaccinations on the childhood vaccination schedule means an ever-increasing risk of toxic metal accumulation in younger children and a greater risk of other adverse reactions and allergies. At the end of the day, however, vaccination is less about medicine than it is about economics. The vaccine industry and the adverse conditions its products create, which often require treatment for life, that's right, treatment for life, represents a revenue stream of billions and billions of dollars that are powerful incentives to continue with business as usual. And it's not just politics. I think it goes deeper, especially now when you think about what's happening with OUYD AI. I think it's deeper than politics. I think it's more, it's everything. It's every arm of the Hydra, you know? Fraser's motivation for writing a thorough history of the peanut allergy epidemic is personal. Her own child had a severe reaction to peanut butter at 13 months of age. Thus, it is a book for thinkers driven by concern from the heart. Two thumbs up. And I'm wondering if a woman, you know, was vaccinated with the peanut oil vaccinations, like a millennial woman, and then she had a child and didn't vaccinate that child, if the child could just get the peanut allergy in some way, acquire it, like acquire the immune dysfunction, right? And then be allergic to it, even though they didn't get the vaccination. Because even if you're not vaccinated yourself, but then you don't, if you are, and then you do it to your, you don't do it to your children, that's just one generation. Like the poison, what I'm trying to say is that the heavy metals of vaccination and all the other ways that we can get all this toxic crud into our system, they get passed down. Like it's because it's in you. So if you're creating something inside of you, it's going to get passed down. So I think it's another thing they're going to use in the future to try to get people away from actually, you know, mating and making love and like starting a family. It's going to be basically saying people are too toxic to mate, which, I mean, could become a reality, unfortunately. But that was a little bit there about the peanut allergy epidemic. Maybe that opened your eyes to something. Maybe you didn't realize that. Maybe you'd heard it before, but hadn't heard this much talked about. I think I might procure this book, by the way, too. It sounds pretty interesting. But again, another example of AIDS. So here they are injecting peanut oil into people to give them allergies so they can hook them up on medicine for the rest of their life. Then we see during OUYD AI, the stillbirth rate going up because of the costume and the stress and the 5G. And we also see that leprosy was a hoax, like viruses are hoaxes. And that was a way that, I guess you could say, they tried to transhumanize and demoralize people by separating them from their family under the myth of contagion. And I really don't think that these people actually believe in contagion, like all these, like, you know, rich, like non-elites or whatever. They obviously don't believe in any of this. They would go to the holistic doctors. They would not see the allopaths. They would see the empirical doctors instead. But they don't believe in any of this type of crap, but they promote it to the peons, to the goyim, to the plebs, but they don't believe in it themselves. They couldn't. So I mean, this is just not some big mistake with everything that they promote. If they didn't, they weren't like, you know, they didn't know what they were doing with the peanut oil. They didn't know what they were doing with the leprosy. They didn't know what they were doing with the mask. Like, this is all known. They know exactly what they're doing. It isn't just like, oh, oops, you know, we messed up. No, definitely, definitely not. So I have another book review I wanted to read. This is about the 1986 Act. And this is about the Vaccine Act from 1986. Maybe some of you know about this. Maybe some of you were old enough to remember when this happened, you know, like in history, watching it on the Jews. But if this is new to you, this is very interesting information. And I'm assuming that if you're listening to this, you're not going to get the OUYD AI vaccination, but maybe there's someone in your family or maybe one of your friends doesn't really understand how this is working. You might want to share this broadcast with them. So this was a movie that came out, I think, let's see, I'm not sure when it came out, but it's called 1986, The Act. And I have not seen this movie, but it's about this 1986 Act. And it's directed by Andrew Wakefield, who I've heard before is a shill. I don't know if that's true. I don't really care. I'm just reading this review of this 1986 Act. In the last year of the Obongo administration, a document was declassified that spills one of the CIA secrets. In 1954, the CIA decided that we needed a vaccination pogrom to enhance American influence around the world and keep up American technology in bioweapons. Wow. Isn't that pretty interesting with everything that's going on nowadays? Did you hear that about that on CNN or Fox News? I don't think you did. So basically back in the 50s, they kind of planned this vaccination pogrom. And here we are now, what, 70 years later? This might raise a few red flags for some people. It also might explain the proliferation of vaccines with a questionable record of safety and effectiveness. It might explain why we have vaccines for diseases that are not that serious. Combine this with CDC, Center for Kosher Disease and Kikery, ownership of vaccine patents, and a patent on an earlier version of the crown virus, and you have some interesting food for thought. By the 1980s, lawsuits over these shoddy vaccines threatened to destroy the vaccine industry. The industry went to Congress with a bill to give them immunity from liability. The bill was not usually popular in Congress, and President Reagan even threatened to veto it, but big pharma lobbyists were up to the challenge. In the end, the bill passed in 1986, thanks to its inclusion in other more popular legislation and, of course, a little political blackmail. The lobbyists argued that without the bill, there would be no more vaccines. And think of all the poor children who will get sick and die. Well, that is so sleazy, but you can't be surprised. Just writing that almost makes me gag. That should not only raise red flags, but set off neon lights and screaming sirens. If their vaccines were so great, why were they being sued into bankruptcy? The 1986 Act effectively gave the pharmaceutical industry immunity from liability for vaccine industries and deaths. So basically, for 34 years, Zog has had immunity from anyone who becomes injured or dies from vaccines. Although the legislation also stipulated certain conditions, these have been openly ignored, at least until recently. For example, the Department of Health and Human Services, the HHS, was supposed to collect safety data and submit a report to Congress every 2 years. HHS has never done that. More recent attempts to obtain safety data from vaccine makers have met with stiff resistance. I've said it before, and here I go again. If they don't want me to see the safety data, then I already know everything I need to know. And that's a good thing to tell other people. Just say, if you're not, you know, people are just, I think, blindly taking it and not even wanting to see the ingredients. It's like when someone eats junk food, they're like, I don't want to look in the back of the package. Like, it's that type of thing. But I mean, eating a bag of chips, that's like a little less forever than this. No sane person would want anything to do with companies behaving like that. I don't want to be their guinea pig or their cash cow. The 1986 Act also established a vaccine compensation mechanism to handle the claims of vaccine injury. Note that these claims are settled with your dollars, collected as a tax on vaccines, not vaccine industry money. Of course, right? Obviously. At first, this system worked reasonably well. Compensation was handed out for various injuries, including autism. That's right. Autism was recognized by the court as a byproduct of vaccines. How did we get from there to now, where the CDC, the Center for Kosher Disease and Kikery, strenuously denies any connections between vaccines and autism? Are more red flags going up yet? Our health shitstem pretends to know nothing about what really causes autism and doesn't seem to see the issue as a very high priority. There are now millions of children and young adults with autism. Who is taking care of them? In the vast majority of cases, their parents are taking care of them. Don't let the TV show The Good Doctor fool you. I don't know what that is. This is not what the average autistic person looks like. And of course, that would be just like the Oyvaz to show something on the Talmud Vision or through the Hollyweird that is nothing like it is in real life. The majority of autistics are completely dysfunctional. I'm not the first to wonder what is going to happen when their aging parents die. If autism rates continue to increase as they have been, we won't even need to wait that long to find out what happens. And I guess all these people are obviously going to be part of Zog, right? Easily. If our medical system continues to unscientifically shut down any open discussion about possible causes, there is little hope of a solution. Andy Wakefield's latest film, 1986, The Act, brings in a well-known example from the auto industry to illustrate what is going on. You may remember the Ford Pinto, which had the unfortunate tendency to explode when rear-ended. I didn't know that, but wow. Ford initially decided not to fix the minor problem until higher powers forced the company to fix it. Why not? They did the math. They calculated that it would be cheaper to let the cars blow up and pay the damages than fix it. The same thing goes on in many other industries, especially in the pharmaceutical world. We are being overtaken by a culture that loves money more than life, and money is their life. Obviously, if we continue this way, many will die, but hey, the good news is that some of us will be filthy rich. This movie is a thumbs up. So interesting there, a little history of the 1986 Act and how they have basically slithered out of being liable, how they will pay you off with your money, and how the CIA has decided back, well, almost 70 years ago, that we needed a vaccination pogrom so we could enhance our American influence around the world so we can flex that American muscle and keep up American technology in bioweapons. And, well, and here we are, right? Almost 70 years later. So obvious how much of this was planned. This stuff was planned before my life, probably yours too. Most of the viewers who are probably listening to this, I mean, it's wild how far back it goes. If people were only willing to listen and have the yarmulke pulled off their eyes, they could see what was going on. So very interesting information over there. Not really the most savory information, but information that is important for people to know, not just us, but also to share with friends and family who may not totally be sold on these ideas, maybe because they're watching the Talmud Vision. I would suggest taking a baseball bat to the Talmud Vision. All right, so moving on a little bit with the broadcast. What else do I want to talk about? Oh, yes, something else. Another review for something else. And I actually watched this documentary. I watched this, I guess about, I don't know, 3 weeks ago. I'm actually surprised that it's still up on YouTube, considering how much they have scrubbed. But maybe they just weren't able to find this one, so who knows. But it is about an incident that took place about 2 decades ago with this anthrax vaccination pogrom that mainly targeted the U.S. military. And this pogrom ended with many military men and women being disabled or dying from the vaccination. I'll post a link for this right now in the chat so the people who are listening in the chat can get this link. And then when I do the show, I will post the link for this documentary. So in case you wanted to watch this, I remember kind of when this was happening in the world, this whole, of course, I remember 9/11. I remember the whole anthrax thing. This was like half my life ago, essentially. But watching this thing a couple of weeks ago really brought me back up to speed. So let me just grab it right here and get the copy the link. Okay. Let's see. I'm going to just pop it right here in the chat for everybody. There we go. Okay. So now if you want to watch this later on, you will have a copy of it. And I'll just put this into the archive later on for people who are listening later in the archives. So yeah, here's a review of this documentary called Vaccine Syndrome, which was all about this whole anthrax hoax that damaged a lot of people back about 2 decades ago. Biological weapons can be dangerous for both sides of a conflict. Using them can be like spitting into the wind. You can end up with more on your own face than in the enemy's. Such weapons can and often have escaped containment. For this and many other reasons, biological weapons have been banned worldwide. Though we are told that some governments, especially in the Mideast, still utilize them. And this comes mostly from high-level government and military officials who often turn out to be the biggest liars. As a result, I have very low confidence in these sources of information. Unfortunately, that information has been used to justify forcing vaccinations on our military personnel. In September 1999, President Clinton signed the Executive Order 13139, mandating that all military service people receive an anthrax vaccine that was not FDA approved. You know it's pretty bad when even the FDA doesn't approve it. Almost 100 violations were found in the lab that produced the vaccination, and about 35,000 soldiers have died from vaccine-related adverse effects. So 35,000 men and women from this anthrax vaccination, at least that's what they're telling us. One vet describes the 35,000 as casualties of friendly fire through a needle. Meanwhile, the number of soldiers who died in Afghanistan and Iraq was just over 4,000. Testimonials from many survivors permanently injured by the vaccination fill this video. Many would rather have taken a bullet than the vaccination. They have been treated worse by their own superiors than by the enemy. Well, that's because their superiors work for the enemy. Just to make things a little worse, the anthrax vaccination consists of several shots followed by yearly boosters. Kind of sounds like maybe the direction that Oyed AI is going to go in. Former FDA head of inspections, Colonel Sam Young, said he would not take this vaccination. Russian Colonel Ken Alibek, MD and PhD, the inventor of weaponized anthrax, said there is no vaccination that works against weaponized anthrax. He also said there is no safe vaccine at all. I'm surprised this video has survived to this point on YouTube. And as far as I know, anthrax isn't even a, quote, virus. Like, I remember when this was happening as a youngster, 20, and I didn't, excuse me one second. And I think, I remember thinking that whatever this anthrax stuff must be, it must just be like some type of poison. Like, I think I just intuitively thought that, and I was really not a big consumer of the news at that point. I really never have been a big consumer of the news, which is probably actually a good thing, because sometimes I'm able to form my own inclination as to what something is, as opposed to like what they're inundating and irritating people with. It is bad enough that we subject so many of our young people to the obscenities of wars of dubious value on the other side of the planet. Translation, a Zog war, a Jewish harvest. And it is bad enough that one in three comes back with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. But it is beyond disgusting when they are abused and treated like slaves who have no right to decide what is injected into their bodies. They are told they must obey this lawful order to get vaccinated, which puts them in the position of having to choose between what is lawful and what is right, which are sometimes two different things. Usually they're two different things. Unfortunately, many older adults still have trouble grappling with the distinction. The concept is especially difficult to contend with in the rigid authoritarian system like the military. To their credit, many young Americans made the right choice in the face of stiff pressure to follow orders, even though the price of choosing what was right was jail time and a felony for their record. So back in the day, if you didn't submit and get this vaccination for anthrax and you were in the military, you basically had to have a felony on your record, or jail time, or basically pay a fine, which is incredible. But could this possibly happen again? I don't know. I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about the leprosy story at the beginning of the broadcast. So history oftentimes does repeat itself. They didn't do all of it for selfish motives, but rather in the hope of helping their fellow soldiers. These individuals showed admirable courage, integrity, and character, and I salute them. Thumbs up. So yeah, definitely an interesting documentary to take in, especially if you're kind of hazy on that time, or if you were really, really young and you don't really remember that time at all. It's worth watching, especially thinking about what's happening now in the world with Oyed AI. It's always kind of interesting to go back and see something from really just not that long ago, two decades ago, and then see how they do the whole thing over again. I mean, I was watching AIDS footage from like the early 90s at the beginning of Oyed AI, and just looking at how amazingly similar it was compared to what they were trying to promote with Oyed AI. So always a good tool to have to go back and to look or read into something from decades back. Oftentimes they're using the same tricks. Okay, so now switching gears a little bit. So we talked a little bit about all the AIDS pogroms, all the immune system pogroms, the way we can acquire an immune system deficiency in this Oyve Shitstum system that seeks to basically, you know, disable and maim everybody, but keep them alive long enough to steal their, to take their shekels. That's kind of like what it seems like when you pull it all back. So I wanted to talk about another war, because I have a war on the immune system. Then we also have a war on people's bodies, especially people's body parts. And one of those wars, and it's a current war, and it's manifesting in a couple of different ways. It's the war on women's breasts. And we see this war manifesting in many ways, from people who have gotten cancer and have gone through with the allopathic, quote, treatment for that and have gotten a mastectomy. We also see it through people who think that they are not girls or not women, and they think that they have a sexual dysphoria and they get their breasts removed. Seeing a lot of this nowadays, this is definitely the lobotomy of this century. And I've also seen them calling this, you know, they call it usually a bilateral mastectomy. That's what they usually call it. Some people actually do it if there's just a history of cancer, you know, genetic, you know, that whole genetic idea they try to promote with us. I've been promoting that since the 60s, the allopathic genetic idea of disease, hereditary. So they will tell someone to prophylactically get it. That's another kind of a way someone can do this via cancer. Even if they don't actually have it, they're told they should do this now because they will. Like, look at that type of programming. Like, oh, you better do this now. Like, the whole genetic thing is almost like the whole contagious thing. Like, people are like, oh, I'm just going to get it anyway. You know, I might as well just, like, not even try. Like, whatever. You know, it's that type of, like, defeatist attitude. That's what it is. Like, when you tell people that something is genetic or contagious, it makes them feel very defeated. It makes them feel like they're not going to fight because they fight for it because they know that, well, it's pointless, right? So those are a couple of ways that we're seeing the manifestation of the war on the body through these mastectomies, whether it's for breast cancer or whether it's for people who have sexual dysphoria. I've also seen some websites referring to when young girls or people who think they're trannies get this, they're now referring to it as a masculoplasty, not a mammogram, that's a different word, not a mastectomy. They're calling it a masculoplasty because I guess it makes someone look more masculine if you don't have breasts, but just calling it that, I think, is kind of an NLP, like neuro-linguistic programming or pogroming. So someone associates it with something totally different than, you know, basically their removal of their breasts. They have to always soften, right? It's like when people say they're getting a tooth removed. No, you're getting part of your body amputated, but they don't say that because they just don't. You know, they want to make it seem very smooth. Like back in the day, they used to call when someone was a tranny and they were getting, you know, like their penis like made into a vagina or their vagina made into a penis, they would call it sexual reassignment surgery. Now they call it gender confirmation surgery. So look at how they soften. They use language to sell their poison, their treatments, right? I mean, how could a treatment for someone if they were sick, whether mentally or physically, be to cut off part of their body? That's so here we have the war on the body before we had the war on the immune system. So this war comes in many ways. It comes with people doing the quote cancer treatments, comes with people doing the treatments for sexual dysphoria. And I would say to an extent it comes through this whole culture of people putting these bags inside their breasts, you know, these implants and stuff, because most people really don't need those. Maybe if someone was born with some type of birth defect where one breast was like non-existent or was extremely small, then maybe there's a reason there for doing something like that. But most people don't need these. I think they've just been, they've been told, or they think that they need them and then they get them, or they think that men like them. And I don't really think men do. Maybe they like the way they look because they like breasts, but they really don't like the way they feel. So there are so many different ways that there's a war on breasts. And I think it's natural to like breasts because they're the things that fed all of us, right? So in a way, when someone's, you know, admiring them, it's just something that is kind of like a relic of the natural world, right? Because that's the way that we all get fed. Of course, now they want to take us away from that too. They want to paint breastfeeding as incest, or they want to refer to it as chest feeding. Mind-boggling. So this war on the body, especially the war on breasts, is also a war against women because they are trying to erase natural women, natural femininity, replace it with this grotesque feminist anti-femininity, and also trannies. They want all these like guys to be trannies and pretend to be women. So here is a review of this book called Boobs, The War on Women's Breasts. Our mainstream medical shitstem is still widely trusted despite a rather pathetic track record, an allopathetic track record, right? The basis for this trust is a lot of fake Jews put out by an industry that is very adept at patting itself on the back. In the film Boobs, seeks to counter the fake news and the few facts specifically on the subject of mammograms. And of course, this is like the colonoscopy of breasts. They always tell you after a certain age, you've got to squish your boobs and stick them in this machine and radiate them. Dr. Ben Johnson and other experts on the biological effects of radiation are interviewed to have some interesting points to make. One of the first points that a mammogram exposes you to about the same amount of radiation as 100 x-rays. Wow, that is incredible. Next point, contrary to their reputation, mammograms do not achieve early detection. By the time a tumor is large enough to have been detected by the mammogram, it has probably been growing for 5 years or more. Next point. False positives and false negatives are so routine that the mammogram procedure is hardly better than flipping a coin. But they have convinced middle-aged women everywhere that it is very important to flip that coin once a year or so, whether it really does any good or not. It's the, quote, standard of care, which really means the insurance and pharmaceutical industries have decided this is the best way for them to make money. And this standard of care stuff is beyond mind-boggling. It's just about the dollar. It doesn't really have anything to do with the person's wellness or well-being. When I do my second part of my allopathy show, I'm going to go more into standard of care. Doctors and nurses are just trapped in the shitstorm as their patients. When you see a conventional doctor, you're putting yourself at the mercy of industries that say they care, and they do care very deeply about your money. If you need to lose weight, they will help you lose weight, mostly in your wallet. They'll respond to concerns about radiation by claiming that you get the same amount of radiation on an airplane. Okay, maybe true, but on the plane, that radiation is evenly distributed all over your whole body. A mammogram concentrates it just on the chest, which makes a big difference. Wow, you really get that much radiation on an airplane, as much as 100 x-rays all over your body? Wow, that's really gross. I'm not sure flying on a plane is the greatest thing for your health anyway. Yeah, I guess not. I mean, I've always kind of held that belief, like growing up, that it wasn't really good to do a lot of airfare for like a lot of the health issues. Like I think there's like benzene, all different types of chemicals that you're exposed to when you're flying. And I think there's definitely something to that. And also I think the idea of going back and forth to different time zones all the time, like if someone does it frequently, I think that also might be not a good idea for you, like your circadian rhythms. According to a study published in The Lancet, not only does mammography not decrease breast cancer mortality, but increases overall deaths. Of course, they need to make money and they need to weaken people while they do it, right? This is how they give people AIDS. The stress associated with false positives could be part of that. So they're inducing it, just like with Oyed AI, right? Like I know some people are thinking that the Oyed AI is just literally just like tossed out this like, you know, this micro dust to get people ill, and that's what people are actually getting, and it's not a virus. People actually think that too. I don't think that's true, because I think really everybody would be affected by that. I think it's really just people have ramped themselves up with fear. The average person is extremely unhealthy. The average person does a lot of things wrong, like just unconsciously or subconsciously. And that was enough to really just get people going and to make them ill. And people usually get ill around, certain times of year anyway, just based on habits that they have. So I don't think there's any dust right now out there. But I do think at some point I wouldn't put it, above them to do something like that. But just what I'm saying is the stress of a false positive mammogram, or the stress of just thinking the virus was around and you could get it, or the stress of something, someone thinking something is genetic, the stress of all that genetic contagion, false positive, all of that stress could basically be the catalyst for the disease. It is also very abusive process involved in smashing a lot of body parts that might have a tumor. Yeah, supposedly, I've never done this before, but supposedly they put your breasts in this machine and just squeeze like all around. Like, I mean, how weird is that? Like, that's like an alien invasion. That's like those anal probes that aliens would supposedly do. Like, how weird is that? Here, put your breasts in this machine. Let's squish them to see if there's something in there that shouldn't be in there. You know, and then we'll use toxins as we squish them. I mean, it really doesn't make any sense. Never a good idea. Apparently, Switzerland is the only country that has gotten the message and banned mammograms. So that's good to hear. The video makes some strong recommendations for prevention and alternative methods of screening. If you must get screened, thermography, especially when combined with ultrasound, has much higher accuracy than mammography. There is no smashing, no radiation, and not even any touching. But there are also ways to reduce your risk, for example, by tossing your junk food in the garbage. Bras that are too tight will cut off blood and lymph circulation, and poor circulation can absolutely lead to cancer. This film does a good job of giving women better information and much better choices than mammography. The thumb is up. So this is another film, and again, it's called Boobs, The War on Women's Breasts. So yeah, there's many wars on women's breasts. There's mammography, there's all the, quote, treatments for breast cancer, or even other types of things they do when they remove people's, like, you know, uterus and ovaries and all this type of stuff. It just seems so weird. Like, in a way, like, that almost seems like the first tranny surgery. Like, the experimentation they've done removing these parts from women. And now they're actually doing it to women who think they're men or just don't want to be women. So these young gals, I saw something yesterday where these people, they refer to themselves as detransitioners. And they're people who thought they were trannies, who now aren't trannies, who may have started taking the hormones, who may have started doing things like, you know, gotten their breasts removed, like done these things, grown a beard, all this crazy stuff, like basically on their way to becoming a guy. Maybe they didn't fiddle down there and they still have, you know, an intact vagina and didn't do phalloplasty and these other crazy surgeries where you need to harvest all of this skin on your forearm to actually make a penile shaft. These things shouldn't be done, obviously. I mean, they just shouldn't. It's just crazy. And what's also, I've been thinking about this too, they want to paint this idea in the Zio media that in order to be a woman, you have to like look a certain way. Like you have to, you know, be a very glamorous person with high heels and like lipstick. Because oftentimes when guys become trannies, they kind of do that type of thing where it's always like an overly made up woman, like especially these drag queens, but not every woman looks like that. So I think maybe sometimes this whole tranny psyop might be appealing to young women who maybe don't feel like they fit into that super glamorous, you know, type of woman. And not every woman is like that. So they think, oh, I must be a guy, or I must not be a woman, or I don't want to be a woman if I have to look like that. Like, I think a lot of them maybe just aren't actually, like, they feel like they're men. They just maybe don't want to be a woman because their idea of what a woman has to be is like this really toxic image, or they've been so inundated with all these ideas that they're going to get raped and things like that because of all this like lib shit rape culture, which the lib shits basically created with all their promotion of, you know, mass immigration and the pill and condoms and all of this other disgusting stuff. But I guess I can kind of understand why it might be scary for a young woman or a young girl to almost feel like this is not a world they want to be a woman in because it's not a high trust society anymore. But the answer is never cutting off your breasts or taking hormones. That's never the answer. The answer is becoming the person that you want to become and not butchering your body and pretending that you're some other sex, because that's not possible. It's impossible to change your race or your sex. It's just not. I mean, and why would you want to anyway? But it's just so sad hearing these stories of these young gals, Zoomers, like I think, you know, like 22, one of these girls was really, really young and they had done this. They had started taking like testosterone. They had gotten the breast removal, the masculoplasty as they're calling it, right? And then they were realizing like they regretted it. And they went back to like living as a woman and not doing this stuff. And they realized it was a growing pain they were going through, just, you know, kind of becoming yourself, which we all, I guess, have kind of gone through, boys and girls, when we become, you know, men and women. And she realized it was the wrong thing that she had done. And then she also realized that after she had done this, she really couldn't do much else. I mean, you can get a reconstruction, I think, like somebody would do if they had had cancer and gone through with the allopathic, quote, treatment for that. But I think it's kind of hard to really make that tissue the same way. You're going to have to do something where you stretch out the existing tissue with like a ball or sort of like inflated device underneath it to stretch that tissue, because tissue has been removed. When you get that done, you have tissue removed. It's kind of different than just a mastectomy, because oftentimes that will leave a certain amount of tissue depending on how much they're taking out for the cancer. But for this, when you really want to create the illusory perspective that there are no breasts, then they remove all of the tissue and just leave the nipple, like a man would have, where he has the pectoral muscle, small amount of fat or more depending, and then the nipple. So it's really quite a raw shock for someone to have done that to themselves, because they felt in some instances like they wanted to off themselves. They wanted to kill themselves, but they did this to themselves, and now they're in this stead where they probably want to kill themselves more because of what they've done. I even have been seeing some stuff too, where you can buy all these like hormones and stuff really easily online. So even if, like, let's say someone has a parent that they don't, doesn't approve of any of this stuff, as long as they're able to, you know, use someone's credit card or get access to paying for something online, they can just buy these hormones, like on Instagroid, all these tranny hormones. I mean, that's terrible to think that some 12-year-old could be in front of the computer on antisocial media buying this with like a parent's credit card, right? And then taking them, and the parent has no idea. I mean, this is just, this whole thing is like, seems like just this whole culture has become like an AIDS culture, where they want to do everything they can to destroy our immune system and create a war on the body. And with Wade AI, it seems like this is the accumulation of all of this happening at once, all of this type of stuff, all the pinnacle of all the weakening they've done ever since, I think, most notably, White War II. I mean, think about it. We had the soil change with the NPK. We had vaccination pogroms. We had things taken out of the diet, like, thyroid being outlawed. So we had the advent of circumcision. And then in the 60s, we had all the race mixing stuff and the immigration stuff. I mean, they've been priming for this for a very long time. And it's really about the immune system, I think, because if they're going to go after one's soul for like the hard game or like the end game, you have to get there through the immune system. Like, you have to weaken someone to that point that you can get there through that. That's kind of how I'm seeing it all. It's interesting kind of sitting back and watching it and not being a part of it, but still being affected by it, but not being caught up in the mix the way other people who were kind of hysterical and caught up in it. Because we're all kind of wondering, like, where is it going to go from here? Like, what's the next tell going to be, right? Like, what's going to happen next? But it's also nice to kind of somewhat be detached from it, but also be engaging in commentary, I guess, at the same time is how I'd, you know, sum it up. So just a little bit there about the war on the body. I had talked a bit in the allopathy show, The Most Pathetic Religion. I talked a little bit about the Zog allopathic war on women's bodies and all the ways that they do that through all the things. And I wanted just to talk about it a little bit more, because I had that book review or that movie review I wanted to read. And also in the last night or so, I was looking into these people who are regretful of transitioning. And you know what? These people who detransition, the ones who thought they were trannies and then said, hey, you know, I was going through a growing pain. I'm really not, you know, I want to be myself now. They're getting the same type of vitriol hurled at them that people get when they leave the vegan club. Oh, you were never vegan. You were never a tranny. Like, they're getting the same type of crud hurled at them. I mean, who would ever want to be part of these clubs, right? I mean, imagine being part of the vegan club and the tranny club. I mean, yikes, crazy, crazy stuff. I hope that all of this tranny stuff just really tightens up or goes away, because I feel like it's really harming a lot of people. And who's to say, like, all these young people who were young enough, like, who even has the head on themselves to basically get their body part removed, like, when they're 20 years old? I mean, and who's to say all these children weren't vaccinated, you know, to the gills with all this stuff, got all the peanut oil injected into them too. Who's to say that? Maybe that doesn't just cause things like anaphylactic shock, but that could be messing with your mind in a load of ways. I mean, there's so many ways that these vaccinations could even be programming the younger generations to do this crud, where they'd actually think about like cutting their body off. It's crazy. So now I wanted to switch gears a little bit after talking about all the immune system shitstem pogroms that they're engaging in. I guess this show is kind of like a little bit of an allopathic show too, just kind of a little bit of a different vibe, more orating than talking today. But I've been doing some good research and been getting pretty inspired, so that's why there's been a few more shows from me lately on the network. So I wanted to switch the gears a little bit and talk about something on the health vein, right? A way that we can kind of, I don't know, bump up our immune system as opposed to having it be, just suppressed, right? Suppressing speech, suppressing the immune system, suppression. So let's talk about hydration. Since we don't want to drink the Kool-Aids, let's talk about ways that we can actually hydrate ourselves. And one of the ways that many of us were taught that we can hydrate ourselves is from water. And yeah, it's good to drink water, especially if it's healthy water. If it's unhealthy water, you're probably doing yourself more harm than good. It would be a good idea, I guess, to encourage everyone to have some type of water filtration system, especially for their drinking water. But also you would want to think about doing it for the water that comes out of the shower or the bath, because you're, of course, going to be getting that into your body through all your pores. And you also might want to think about getting one for the whole house if you got to that level, depending on where you're living. So you could actually have all your clothes be washed in like good water, brushing your teeth, washing your hands, etc. So water is just one way that we can get hydration, but it's actually not the best way to get hydration. And water is best when it is mineralized. So it's a good idea to add back some minerals to your water, depending on what minerals those are. I like to use a mixture of sodium, potassium, and magnesium. There are certain minerals you definitely want to avoid, like you don't want to have any mineral waters or mineral supplements that are high in calcium, because it's better to get calcium from foods like dairy and stuff like that than to be getting calcium from calcium drops or calcium minerals, because that can cause calcium to go into the soft tissue of the body as opposed to the bone, and it could also form like a calculus or a plaque on the teeth. So that's definitely something that we don't want to do, and you're going to have to look around to know what water, mineral water, is high in calcium. I kind of just stopped drinking them because I got the feeling that a lot of them were actually high in calcium and causing some calculus on my molars. So I decided to not do that. And now I have my own machines. I can make up my own sodas and my own club sodas. And I typically will add drops, like I just mentioned, back to my water. So water is good, but there are 7 habits that you can utilize that actually will hydrate your body. And oftentimes, if we're just drinking like plain water, like then we're just going to be peeing out our minerals. And if we're drinking crappy water, that's going to be doing harm. So really, water is one of those things that is kind of invisible in a lot of ways. Like people can be thinking like they're doing everything else right, but they don't really think about their water. So just something to think about. I've talked about water before on other broadcasts in the past, but nevertheless, it's always important to make sure that your water is good, not just for drinking and for like tea, coffee, whatever, but also for cooking, you know, also if you're making soups and stuff like that. So here are 7 habits that actually hydrate your body. And we're going to go through these 7 habits. And then I think we'll wrap up the show, because I think I'm going to be having some dinner pretty soon. So 7 habits that actually hydrate your body. Number 1 is trigger point therapy. And number 2 is corrective exercises and dynamic stretches that respect our gait cycle. Your gait is your walk. That's G-A-I-T, not G-A-T-E. Eating more raw saturated fats, drinking less water, more fresh juice, hot magnesium baths, and less cooking of foods. So in the prior show, I had talked about eating more raw foods, right? Talking about eating more foods in their natural state. So here are some top foundational habits for cellular hydration. So number 1 is something I've talked about also before in my stress shows, is trigger point therapy. Allows old and hardened lymph and calcified tissues to loosen and begin removal of this waste from our fascia. Think of an analogy of a squeezed sponge.
We squeeze it to remove the crud and crap stuck within it, allowing it to soak up new clean water once released. Similarly to our fascia slash body, when we apply deep pressure to knots and adhesions built up throughout the body through stress, we are squeezing the sponge. When we release or let go of that trigger pointing after a few minutes, our body can begin circulating new nutrients, blood flow, and oxygen to places the hydration could not reach beforehand. So trigger point therapy, you can get yourself one of those kind of trigger pointing rollers. You can find them at most places online. I bought one about 5+ years ago, and it's very helpful to do that occasionally. Sometimes it will hurt depending on what you're looking to, kind of like massage and move over. You can also kind of do it with your own fingers, or you can give yourself kind of a deep massage. Number two would be corrective exercises. When we respect the gait cycle, training and dynamic stretches that build a strong foundation to posture, this allows the structural side to align more efficiently, allowing more space for optimal digestive flow, lymph drainage, and circulation. And yeah, posture is extremely important. I see most people not having good posture. Posture is important not just for, I guess, your breathing, but also for just for your digestion, for really everything. Posture is very, even when eating, it's really important for everything. Like when some people, they eat, they kind of bend themselves over, like they crane themselves over, that can cause digestive problems. Like if you look at people back in the day, they would eat sitting down and they would eat with like the food or their bowl to their face, like how Asians eat noodles. That's a much better way to eat than craning your whole torso down and putting pressure on your digestive tract. So if you're having digestive issues, think about how you're eating. Are you eating sitting at a table that's very high up? Are you sitting at a table and you're craning yourself over and just kind of, pushing your organs as you basically eat? That is a very poor way to eat. Your better way to eat is either to eat on the floor or to sit with your, with your back upright and your spine straight and to put the food to your mouth as opposed to putting your face to the plate. Just a thought, there are so many habits that people just do, become like modern, with triple parentheses, modern habits that are extremely deleterious. The whole idea of basically sitting on the couch and kind of like hoovering over into a bag, like they've created these habits based on how they've marketed lifestyle in a lot of ways. Number three would be raw saturated fat. We talked about this on the last broadcast. It's the most utilized nutrient in the body, especially in this toxic industrial world. Raw fat is a true lubricant, which facilitates movement without frictional deterioration, protects the cells from heat, cold, and caustic substances, whilst providing hormones to regulate activity. And yes, saturated fat is the best fat that we can eat, and the best way to eat it is to eat it raw. And of course, that would be in the form of raw butter, raw milk, raw cream, tallow, suet, stuff like that. Those are all raw. Like I said in the last show, I aim for about a 50-50 with raw and cooked, but I'm probably going to go more into the raw stuff as the weather becomes warmer and I experiment more with more things. Number four is drink less water. Water that is not in raw food has no active ions nor minerals bound in nutrients. It must have all three properties or it is 10% cellularly utilizable. Water leaches nutrients from our blood and intestines. So yeah, I definitely think that we should drink water, but I think some people might be really just slamming that down and not having enough of other liquids and other ways to hydrate. Number five, fresh juices. Fresh juices are important for hydration because they contain non-toxic vitamin, enzyme, and minerals naturally found when the produce is grown properly. This helps replace minerals lost from stress and years of eating overly cooked foods. And juices are one of those things that if you make them yourself, they're raw. It's really hard to find raw juice now in the store. Like everything is pasteurized, it seems. But fresh juice raw is one of the easiest ways to get someone introduced into raw food, right? Because it's juice, right? Fruits are the easiest foods to get people on or aware of the importance of raw food. And that would depend on what type of juices you want to make. You could make whatever you want, even a smoothie, which would kind of be the same thing as the juice.
I guess just depending if it had seeds or not. Like oftentimes I'll make myself a smoothie. Like right before this broadcast, I had a smoothie. I had dragon fruit and passion fruit with cherries, and I buzz that up. I use a little bit of coconut water, just, and then I buzz that up in a glass blender, and then I put that in a bowl, and I topped it with raw cream and bee pollen. So it's not really a juice, but it still is hydrating, and it had, you know, good amount of minerals and stuff like that, good source of carbohydrates. Oh, and I also had that with a raw egg too. I just sucked down like a raw egg for a quick snack, you know. Number six, hot magnesium bath. Ideally, adding some apple cider vinegar and raw milk will help keep the skin hydrated from the heat. Cleopatra supposedly took those raw milk baths. Something I always wanted to do was a milk bath. Maybe I'm going to do that one day. Just buy a big jug of milk and do it. Another great tool for loosening hearted lymph is the magnesium baths. Also good for calcification, drainage through the skin of heavy metals, toxins, and pollutants. So yeah, bath is great. It's also a great way to get those magnesium minerals into your skin, especially if your gut tends to be sensitive and you feel like this is a better way transdermally. I myself, through my own experimentation, have found that I prefer the transdermal way to get magnesium into my body, or I'll have a couple of just the drops in some of the water that I drink. But the idea of taking like magnesium pills, like especially these like horse pills, they're really big. I really don't want to have all that in my stomach and then, you know, fighting or ready for digestion with all that type of stuff is like extra effort. And number seven on the list of how to hydrate, less cooking of foods. Eating cooked food forces our pancreases to send hormonal and electromagnetic messages to every cell in our bodies. Those messages demand nutrients be leached from our cells to replace the nutrients lost during cooking and processing. Our cells lose the vitamin, enzymes, and structured water contained in them for necessary functions for digestion, assimilation, and utilization of cooked and processed foods. Something to think about there in regards to cooking your food and not cooking your food, and maybe doing a little bit of both, experimenting with both, or even experimenting with softer ways of cooking food, wetter ways to cook food, simmering, poaching, steaming, you know, using more wet ways of cooking as opposed to the dry ways of cooking like roast, fry, grill, saute, things like that. We tend to gravitate more towards those dry methods of cooking if you look, especially when you eat outside the house. It seems like everything is dry cooked. You read a menu and look at it, everything seems to be dry cooked. Those wetter foods we oftentimes associate with being ill or with an invalid or with a baby or something like that. But those wetter foods, and they're softer, they're easier to digest. Like chicken that has been softly simmered in some chicken stock is going to be easier to digest than chicken that was like cooked at a very high heat and grilled. Also, the softer cooked food will make your body more flexible, and the raw food will make your body even more flexible than that. So there are all these different ways that you can kind of hack it yourself. And just have fun with it, I guess. Don't get too stressed out or serious about all of this, but I guess I like to point these things out more than once, so I guess we get the message. And some people have told me that they appreciate hearing something more than once, so I hope I don't sound like a broken record. I always want to get these ideas of health across to people and always add a little zip and zing of health to the show, especially when I spent the majority of this broadcast talking about all the AIDS-like pogroms that have been launched on humanity in the last, I don't know, 70 or so years, talking about the peanut thing in the 90s, the Vaccination Act in the 80s, the leprosy thing, I think, in the 90s. So really, even since my childhood, all these pogroms, the anthrax pogrom, all the stuff going on now with the war on women's breasts. But finally, we can leave on a high note in regards to how we can hydrate ourselves. And if we're better hydrated, maybe our minds will be more open and our bodies will be more flexible. And that's a definite plus, especially in this world where I think we're going to really need to have ourselves in a good, vitalized, vigorous state, because things might get a little weird for a while. Seeing people just kind of, you know, drink the Kool-Aid, right? So nobody drink the Kool-Aid. Hydrate yourself well. Massage yourself. Take a bath. Do some yoga. Eat some raw fat. And You have been listening to White Wellness. I am your host, Tabitha. Be sure to catch all the wonderful broadcasts over here at the one and only American National Radio Network. Sat Nam, everybody.